I certainly consider John McEwen as one of those legends. So many years playing music, the string wizard, a founding member of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. This is part two of our conversation in the second hour of today's program. We focus on John's brand new biography, a wonderful book, the title of which is The Life I've Picked, A Banjo Player's Nitty Gritty Journey. You're going to enjoy it. I hope you listened last week. We get into the book. We get into John's life. Things are not in the book. Some things that are, but not all the detail, because that would make buying the book superfluous. Don't forget the second hour, part two of our visit with the string wizard, John McEwen. And if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to John McEwen, who's been a frequent contributor to Unreal Bluegrass, for which I'm always appreciative. John, there's a great part in one of the chapters in the book, and I like the way this part of this non-linear progression of the band, and I'm not trying to sound real special, I just don't know how else to say it, but as you're doing the band, you have this opportunity. You mentioned Paint Your Wagon. I got to go back and find that and watch it. Because this story, you're a band, you're on the radio, and you're hanging around a movie set to be in a movie, Paint Your Wagon. And just the whole way that it develops, it's almost like the perfect story about, you know, the Dillards. They went out west in California, and they're like, all of a sudden they're on TV, and here's the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And you spent a lot of time on set. I don't know how many.
4 months.
4 months on the set. How much of the movie were you actually invisible?
About 4.5-5 minutes.
There you go.
And if you could look close in some background scenes. But we were in close-ups of some scenes, and we did Hand Me Down That Can of Beans, which was the featured song. And we were fifth on the billing, right after Ray Walston, the guy that was my favorite Martian.
He was my favorite Martian, yeah. You watched him. But it must have been a blast to be on the set. I mean, you're young, in a band. It must have been a great time.
It's one of my favorite chapters in the book because it captures not only the coming together of the hippie faction of the country at the time, because a lot of the extras were just hippies that had come up from San Francisco or over from Portland or whatever to work as extras in a movie that was supposed to look like 1848. And it did. They didn't have to go to makeup very much because they already had them.
They just had to take their piece belt buckles off, probably.
One of the favorite days. Oh, Tent City was incredible. See, because John Truscott, the set designer, had just won an Academy Award for Camelot.
Ooh.
And it was the days of Hollywood that he had the open checkbook. He bought stuff to put inside some of those stores and things that you would never see on camera. But he bought them so he could take them home later. You know, Tent City had a couple of bars and the Tent Hotel and stores that actually had stuff in them. And it was really cool because people would sit around the campfire if we're shooting at night. They'd sit around various fires playing cards. Or the PH Factor Jug Band was up there. And people would sit around playing music and waiting for a shot to happen. It was such a slow progress on the film. And after the first month, it seemed like you'd been there forever.
I guess so.
And about 3 months into it, this is in the book, where you see cop cars pull up down the production
right,
office
right.
About 1,000 feet away, and a big announcement over the hidden speakers. Well, John Forsythe, please come down to the production office. And John, right now, come on down to the... you hear this rustling in one of the tent hotels, and that's the guy they're looking for. He's throwing stuff together. He runs out and jumps on a horse and takes off into the mountains. And the cop cars come onto the Tent City set, but it's all muddy streets, and they get bogged down and can't move. And all these 300 extras are standing around laughing at him. You know, they never did get their man. He'd been writing hot checks all over Oregon.
I mentioned early on that I've seen you, where you do different media presentations and you perform, and you know, I've also seen you do kind of a multi-mix thing where you show the footage from the band's trip, from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's trip to Russia, and then you tell stories about it and you play music. But then you have all this film from that. Really was the... I saw you do it. I saw you talk about it, John. You still get emotional. I don't think you're that good of an actor. I think you're an actor because you're a performer. But you get emotional about the response that you got from the people in Russia and how happy
it's
the response
that American music got.
Yeah, oh, okay.
We were the foils. We were the stand-ins to represent. Jeff did a Chuck Berry song, and he rocked it. He was doing the chicken walk across the stage. and we took a female singer, Jan Martin, with us, and she sang Georgia and a couple other hot songs, and here we are doing these songs that weren't in the, some of them weren't in the Dirt Band songbook, but we felt it important to represent other parts of American music. They'd never seen an American band.
Yeah.
The concert sold out because it was not because it was Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. You come from America. We can't wait to see American band.
And that, and John, that was in the time when it wasn't just a Cold War. It was a freezing Cold War.
It was a hot Cold War.
Yeah.
Is what it was for
Yeah.
It was a very.
You didn't have a lot of freedom of movement, as I recall.
We were only allowed to go. We weren't supposed to go more than a 10-mile radius away from whatever hotel we were at. And the hotel in Riga, for instance, had a 3-block circumference of security people that we didn't know about until the third day there, and somebody told us that they were only letting people into the area of that hotel where the American band was if they had a reason to be there, you know, business of some kind. And they controlled the whole mindset of people, and there was no freedom. And you could see it in the people when they started standing up one at a time and minutes apart. So everybody would look at the person standing up until the security people made them sit down because it was illegal to stand up. But then too many were standing up. Then the whole crowd was on their feet, and the girl runs up and gives somebody flowers. My favorite story, Irina was one of the Communist Party member ladies that was in charge of part of the tour management, you know, getting around. Boys, we leave hotel for concert hall at 5 p.m. Be at the bus, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she was...
You do that really well, by the way.
We got to Leningrad. Thank you very much.
It's Boris and Natasha all over again.
Спасибо. Thank you in Russian.
Okay. You're welcome.
Leningrad was the third city. 5 shows in each city. No, wait a minute. 1, 2, 3. 4th city. And she was saying, now, when we get to Leningrad, the audience will be different. They won't be crazy like the Armenians or the Latvians. There'll be a Russian audience, very respectful. You will probably get an encore, but you maybe just one encore, because that is a respectful thing to do. You will not see this silliness we have seen, this disrespectful audience. And I will never forget walking off stage after the 3rd encore, and on the 2nd encore, 2 women had run up and thrown their arms around Jeff. And on the 3rd encore, 2 sailors had come up and played air guitar next to John Cable, the guitar player. On the 1st encore, a bunch of people were at the front of the stage, and it was obvious we're going to have to do a 4th one. And I walked by tight-haired in a bun Irina in her red outfit, and she has her hand up by her face, and she's saying, I never thought in Leningrad. I never thought. Yeah.
Well, you got off the stage at one point and kind of ran around, didn't you?
Well, at the bike track in Armenia, when that was one of some of our first shows, when that girl in Armenia came running up to the stage with flowers and the audience went nuts, I did my normal thing of jumping off the stage with a fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the thing, Steve. I have recorded, I have hired, played, jammed with, recorded with the best fiddle players ever. I'm talking Bobby Hicks and Stuart Duncan and Vassar Clements and Byron Berline and Mark O'Connor. I know what I do with a fiddle. I'm kind of like, for the people that ski, if you're on the chairlift and somebody's going down the middle of the run, and he looks pretty good. Man, look at that guy. He made a nice parallel turn there. That's the green run under the lift.
Huh.
But if I got on the moguls, you know, the bumps on the hill, they're going to say, call the ski patrol. That guy's in trouble. So I don't go to the moguls on my fiddle. And I'm a guy where people say, you ought to see this guy play the fiddle. But I don't think they ever hear, you never hear, you ought to hear this guy play the fiddle.
I just want to see you.
Yeah, you got to see him play. I saw him play once. It wasn't plugged in, but it was really good. He looked great. I work at the fiddle all the time. I've gotten better in the last, 8 or 9 years. And I can do a pretty decent Fisher's Hornpipe and St. Anne's Reel and a couple other things. But I know, my God, Stuart Duncan is such a magician. And, you know, those people are in a different world. But, yes, I jumped off the stage and the people went nuts. But it wasn't just me. It was the jockey and the horse thing.
Yeah.
I never felt like I did that. I had a great team behind me.
One other thing about the trip in Russia, because it's detailed in the book, and you do have this. If you can catch John, I guess you still do the presentation. Not a regular thing, but you might catch John. You might have the film. But I love this one part. I remember when I saw the video, you talked about it. And in the book, you talk about what's essentially people time-sharing their tickets.
Oh, yeah. That was a weird thing. That happened in Moscow. Either that or that's the first time we noticed it, where somebody had, in the middle of the auditorium when on an aisle seat would get up and run out. And then a minute later, they'd run back in. And somebody on the other side of the hall, get up and run out. Then they'd run back in. And then, boy, those people have to go to the bathroom a lot over here. But there's probably 20 or 30 people that had bought timeshare tickets. Like, we get 20 minutes apiece. Now, you be out there because I want to see for 20 minutes the American band, you know. And they were... A nice, funny idea. What I thought was funny is if they got together after the show, they called it bluegrass. Oh, no. They called it Chuck Berry music. Hank Williams.
These are the blind men describing the elephant in that sense.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. Just think if you could do it today, though, in a venue, if you could sell a timeshare seat. You might be able to talk about the, something to tuck away maybe that's something that's the futuristic thing. I don't know. We've talked a little bit about the circle being unbroken now, and I will tell you my personal experience only in the sense that when it hit the shelves, I remember going into a store that had a record display, and Will the Circle Be Unbroken had all that great drawing that you've described in the front of it. There was a sticker on the shrink wrap, wasn't shrink wrap, then didn't shrink, but it said, if you only own one country album, this is it.
Oh,
and I don't know who put it on there, but it was on every one that was in the stack. But John, that might be still true about Will the Circle Be Unbroken. That might still be the one that if you have no other country, we'll just call it country, and that flavor of music, it still might be the one to have.
It's a very special record. It captures three generations because Randy Scruggs was 17, and Jimmy Martin's son was about that age. He sang background on the song. And Acuff was 140 or something.
Yeah.
And Acuff was the older one. And you had Maybell. And Earl, this is a weird part, Steve. Earl was, I am now, just a second. Oh, my God.
You're counting.
28 years older than Earl Scruggs was when he did the album.
So what you're saying, he was really young on the first Circle album.
Yeah, he was young. I was 24, but he was 48, I believe.
Okay.
And it seemed like he was definitely a previous generation. Well, which he was, but a previous time frame.
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't too many years away from... Well, Vietnam was raging, you know. I remember that... You remember that, too,
sure.
Maybe.
Sure.
You knew that it was kind of like golf. Today, we killed 600 Viet Cong and lost 180 Americans.
That's exactly right.
Whoever had the lowest score won that day.
That's exactly right. That was the news. And John, for people who don't remember, you're talking about the news, the nightly news reports.
Yeah, back in the days when the nightly news actually was news.
Right.
I'm really disappointed in NBC and ABC.
Yeah.
The world news tonight.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's been times when I added up no more than a minute and a half of world news.
Right, right.
Then there's the dog story. And coming up next, when we come back, one show I added a minute and 10 seconds of when we come back stuff that's then recaptured. So I watch Vice News.
That's a good show. The Circle album, we've talked about this before, and I know you explained it. You just kind of, in essence, let the tape keep rolling, and that's how you get all that great dialogue in between the songs.
And the band didn't. My brother,
Bill,
who produced the record,
okay,
knew that there's a lot of important things going down, and ran a tape at 3 3/4, 3 7/8. whatever half of 7.5 is. You know, a slow take.
The people at home can do the math.
Yeah. And thank goodness he did that, because when we did Circle Be Unbroken, the third chorus, it was really hard to keep track of all those mics and people, and it did go into the red a little too much. So there's about 25 seconds that was taken off of the 3 3/4 tape. And, 3 3/4. Yeah. And spliced in there to not have distortion. And it was recorded on quarter-inch tape at 30 inches per second. And the record company, when Bill and I went to the company to convince them, well, to kind of let them know what this band... Well, see, we could have done this if Jimmy and Jeff and Ivy hadn't done the right things to make Uncle Charlie be a successful album with 3 radio songs on it. Go in with that power with the company, they had more of a tendency to listen to the group then, because record companies don't make records, they distribute plastic.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And to
question.
Prove that, here's the kind of manager my brother was. Remember when the streaking thing was happening?
Yes.
Everybody was streaking. He was having an argument with a record company, telling them what they should do. Well, we're the record company, was the response. And he says, listen, the streaking thing has happened. Take the Beach Boys song and go, everybody's gone streaking, streaking USA. And they went, oh, my God, that would be on the radio tomorrow.
So it is.
Good luck. He said, good luck with it. You're a record company. Go make it.
Well, except Ray Stevens made it before they had a chance to do it.
Well, Ray Stevens did the streak.
Right.
But this was a Beach Boys.
I know. I understand. But, I get it.
But the record company couldn't make it.
Right.
You distribute plastic.
Yeah, you're right.
And market it. And advertise it. And that is part of the magic process that was fun then. Even though it was difficult, it was constantly difficult to get through that. But if you survived all those things and you got a record out there, boy, what fun that is.
You, John, that is to me a magic recording. And I pick from it often on Unreal Bluegrass shows. People will hear conversations leading up to things. And mm-hmm. I'll often follow it up with another cut from that artist. It might be one of your cuts that lead into the part where Jimmy Martin says you've been playing the banjo for 15 years, Andrew, or whatever he says to you.
You've been playing that thing for 15 years,
ain't
you?
Or we've never done it like that. So right now, let's get to where you're no longer part of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and you're doing...
Just to fill in the audience, October 22nd of 2017,
right.
After the end of the 50th year tour, I decided months before that would be my... It was time to do these other things. The time was... the band, since I got back in 2001, when I remastered the Circle album, and involvement seemed to be a natural thing, the group only made 2 albums. That's 2 albums in 15 years. That's not me. You know? And I couldn't... I don't know. To me, it was abusing the privilege of being in the music business with success. Do something. Well, nobody's going to... Well, how do you know? You know, make a YouTube video. Let's. Anyway, yes, I left.
And you're still performing. You have a busy. Well, you're calling me from a city where you're in that city. It's not your hometown, but you're going to be performing there. You're touring.
I'm in Pittsburgh tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'm in Pittsburgh, and tomorrow, me and my guys drive 3 hours up to Warren, Pennsylvania, to play a beautiful venue, the Struthers Library Theater. One the Dirt Band played a few years ago. And then that night we'll drive back. We get to the hotel probably about 2, and my flight, I have to be at the airport at 5:30. So to get to Denver. And got a couple dates that are sold out in Denver. I'm very excited. Not Denver, but one's in Denver, one's in Loveland.
You are. You continue to do... people come to you with projects now, soundtracks, and you do like to get involved in movies and different things, and you're doing very well at that. So John, all this time you've kind of built this following. It's amazing to me reading the book how many people that you don't think that you are still, even after the success you've had, like, I don't know if I should really say this, and that person turns to you and says, You're John McEwen. And it's just like, I think you're even surprised partway through the book that everybody knows so much of what you've done. They do sometimes talk about the Uncle Charlie album. But
yeah, like I tell my kids, look, kids, here's the reality. Go into the Walmart and walk around and say, to walk up to people and say, you ever heard of Johnny Cash? You'll probably have a pretty 9 out of 10 situation. And half of them will be fans. Now, then go around the Walmart and say, John McEwen. You might have 1 out of 20. Mm-hmm. If you say Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, you might have 4 out of 10. And then you can say, what about the guy that plays in the, you know, it's, I'm a garage word. I'm not a household word.
But think of all the people that you talk about Johnny Cash. You mentioned him, and there's bits about him in the book. There's one very funny story involving Marty Stewart, which I'm not telling because you have to read it. You have to get the book.
I'm worried about that.
It's in there. No, it's already in there. You can't take it back.
I'm not going to take it out. No, I have trouble with that one. I mean, I'm working with John Carter Cash and on several things, and I mean, he hasn't read this yet. I hope he still calls me.
Don't talk it. We're not going to talk about it, except that Johnny Cash knew you and immediately wanted you to be involved and come over and let's play. And so people in the music, and you know the people in the music business, and there's a neat story in there where you're taking your son to see, hopefully he's hoping to get to meet a band, and they know who you are right away. And it's like,
well, it's Fish.
Yeah, Fish. Yeah. Well, I'm trying not to give it all away. I knew it was Fish. I didn't want to say it.
No, but that's a good Fish story.
It is a good Fish story.
Just see, that's because I didn't listen to my younger children when they were telling me I should pay attention to this group that's come through Salt Lake a few times. And they're playing a club, then they're playing a bigger club, and then they're playing this other place. And I said to Ryan, what do you want for your birthday? He goes, I want to meet Trey Anastasio. I says, okay, I want you to come to a Fish concert with me, and I'd like to meet Trey Anastasio. I'll make it short. So we meet in Sacramento. I think they're playing a club. I open the newspaper, and it says, Arco Arena sold out, Fish. And it's 12,000 people.
Right, yeah.
And I reach Ryan, and I say, well, meet me at the load-in door at 4 o'clock. Well, how do you know they're going to do a sound check? He says, Ryan, everybody does a sound check at 4 o'clock. Meet me at the load-in door, the ramp that goes into the Arco Arena on the west side. I'd been there before.
I guess so.
So we're standing there at the ramp, nothing. It's 5 to 4. Dad, how do you know they're doing the sound check? I didn't tell him that I called a promoter friend at Bookfish and said, oh, yeah, they love to do sound checks, usually at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
But that's also the pattern. And so we're standing there at the ramp. And about 3 minutes to 4, I said, Ryan, listen. And you hear off, listen in the distance. Throw your hearing. And you can hear this. I said, that's a bus. It's over on the other side of the building, but we're feeling the low end. And the same way the whales can communicate across miles of ocean, it's a low end signal. And then the bus pulls around the and comes up to the ramp, starts to go down. It stops. Trey Anastasio hops off the bus and says, John McEwen, I've always wanted to meet you. It's so good to meet you. This is my son, Ryan. He says, hey, you want to sit in tonight? I went, well, sure. If I can get dinner for him and me.
Yeah.
He says, well, hey, Ryan, hop on the bus. All of a sudden, he's gone from the ground floor to the top of the penthouse.
Yeah, that's a great story. That's a great story.
So that was really fun.
It's funny. And that's it, John. The people... You are very humble, and like as I say, you are a fan of music and a fan of musicians, and you're still very humble through it all, and we've touched on tiny little bits.
I don't know. I mean, I do what I can. I know what notes I can do and can't do or try to do, you know, and that's the thing. It just seems like I could have done that one better. Every now and then, I mean, Opus 36 is one of the hardest songs I know. I've only played it right 3 times in my life.
Oh, well.
But I would say most of the people I'd played it for thought it was right.
Well, I thought it was. I saw you a year or so ago.
They didn't hear that mistake that I heard.
Yeah.
I wanted to make that note last longer. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm talking to John McEwen, and you always give me so much time to explore these things, and we're talking about The Life I Picked, the brand-new book, The Life I Picked, A Banjo Player's Nitty-Gritty Journey, and you're funny. John, there are parts of this book where I laugh out loud, and I have post-it notes of things that make me laugh. I'm not going to find them for you now, but you're a good storyteller. You're a funny. You make funny observations about things that are very serious, important, but you also have a funny way of looking at things and discussing things. And I love it, man. I absolutely love it. I've enjoyed the heck out of reading it.
Hey, I started reading it last week. I couldn't put it down.
Is that when you got your copy?
No, it's just
all right. That's okay. Well, listen, has it on the street yet, or people pre-ordering? Okay, good.
It's been number one on Amazon's new releases for country books for 3 weeks now.
Okay.
And the Kindle is number three, and I'm hoping that's not just an initial interest. I hope it spreads, because I'll tell you, I'm telling not just my story, but people that were into music in the 70s,
exactly.
80s, and now.
Right.
You know, I'm telling you some of the things that were seen out there were out there, and some of the difficulties of doing this business. And like when I described, the Alaska story made
yes.
it in there.
Yes.
The one about the band.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it goes into more detail, but since I was clearing dates with the agents about what we could and couldn't make, and I was good at it. I was a damn good road manager, I'll tell you that. And it was fun. So one time I took these dates in this order, day after day. Central Park in New York, next day Grand Junction, next day Anchorage, Alaska, next day Phoenix, next day Aspen. And it was not easy. But since there were no hotel expenses, because we were in the air all the time.
That's right. That's right.
The checks were really good.
It's an amazing story. There are things in here, and we're not going to talk about the June Carter Cash thing. You have to read that. We also won't talk about this, John. You solved the mystery for me that I never understood. And it has to do with Grand Funk Railroad. I understand the lyric now. I never did before. They're going to have to read it to understand that part also.
Oh, yeah, Last Night in Little Rock.
Yeah, that's right. They're going to have
doing our act.
That's right.
The whole band. It's a natural fact.
That's right. So we're going to have to let them read that and figure that one out, too. But there's
that's
so
the
many.
That's one that worries me. I mean, I don't want people thinking I'm telling a dirty story, because it's just what happened.
It's not a dirty story.
And it was the 70s.
That's exactly
okay,
right.
Good.
Yeah, that's right. No.
I mean, my kids are reading this. And
you can't take them out now. You can't
no,
go back
I
and take them back.
Yeah.
It's a great story. There's so many things like that in there. And as I said when we started, someone from like me who was looking at it from the outside, we could never have guessed at the detail that everything was going on and what was going on within the band, personality-wise, and also just being a band and all the things that you did and Paint Your Wagon and all that stuff and where
I'll
you are
you
now.
Something this band has always been damn good at. We'd go out and do a show after having the biggest argument, and it would be one of the best shows of the week. You know?
Yeah.
Why are you, and you, and you, your mother, and you are, you know, whatever. You think you're going to kill each other. And then we'd go out and play, and all that energy would go into the music. And then we wouldn't talk after the show.
And, John, after every show that I've seen you do, and every time you've been on this program, you end the acknowledgments of this book with the same phrase that you always do, and it might be time for you to say that.
like I said to my mom, thanks for having me,
yes. John McEwen, I love talking to you, man. I'm so happy with this book. It's a blast.
And oh, thank
I've
you.
Enjoyed every second of reading it.
Well, thanks for the time, and I hope you help spread. I hope you spread the word, and people have been liking it. I'm so happy about that.
You did a great job. You did a great job. Get some rest for your drive and your shows, and I'll catch up with you somewhere down
That's
the road.
That's a good idea.
All right, brother. See you, John.
Okay.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.